So yeah, so today I'm going to talk about various kinds of science we can get out of line intensity mapping surveys and how we go about doing that. You know, I'm giving a cosmology seminar, so I'm obligated by law to start with this picture. You know, we've gotten pretty good at cosmology in the last 20 years or so. We have really good maps of the large-scale structure of the universe in a two-dimensional surface at redshift 1100, and from the cosmic microwave background. We also have really good maps of kind of more tomographic maps of large-scale structure from large galaxy surveys extending out to redshift one or so. And you know, these things together have let us build up this lambda CDM model of cosmology. We've learned a lot about how galaxies work and you know, done basically everything that's kept everybody in this room employed. But if you, you know, look at those two schematics, there's kind of a gap in here, where the CMB, like I said, is only a two-dimensional surface, and galaxy surveys kind of become, kind of peter out at some point, just because it becomes much more expensive per galaxy to find sources at higher redshifts. So if we put this in kind of a cosmologist's term, where we're trying to get information that just scales with how many modes you have, or in other words, scales with something like the amount of volume you've covered, if we've only surveyed out to redshift one or so, if we look at the cumulative co-moving volume out to some redshift, you know, going out to redshift one is only something like a few percent of the total volume of the universe. So there's a lot more potential volume out there at higher redshift that is not well probed by current galaxy surveys, and you maybe get helped a little further by the fact that the nonlinear scale moves to smaller scales as you go to higher redshift. If you think like an astrophysicist, which I have to apologize to the perimeter crowd a bit, I'm going to do quite a bit in this talk. There's also a lot of interesting galaxy physics in this period. You know, this is where the first stars in the universe were born. This is where galaxies that we use as our large-scale structures, this is where they formed and where they merged and you know, made all of this fancy, messy assembly bias stuff that we might have to worry about. This is where actually the peak of star formation happened. So most, the majority of the stars currently existing in the universe actually formed around redshift 2 to 3 or so, which is also in this period, which is not probed at the level of statistical precision that we as cosmologists would prefer to have at this point. So intensity mapping at its most basic level kind of provides a way to access this, this higher redshift period of cosmic history. You know, not like one object at a time, as you could with something like JWST, but in the kind of full statistical sense that cosmologists like to do so. And the reason why it works basically boils down to intensity mapping uses all the photons. So what do I mean by that? Well, if I consider that I just do, you know, a blind spectroscopic survey of some patch of sky, you know, I have a telescope, I'm going after, you know, some part of the spectrum. For example, say you're going after some carbon monoxide line. So this toy model is a 2.5 square degree survey with VLA. If you spent 4,500 hours on this field, you would detect the galaxies I have marked in red, which is less than 1% of the total galaxies in this field. And 4,500 hours of time on VLA is a lot. It's, you know, you have to convince somebody really hard to even give you that much time in the first place. However, all of these other galaxies in this toy galaxy survey I have here, all of these other ones I have marked in gray, all of those galaxies are still emitting photons. All of those photons are still hitting your detector. They're being recorded by your detector. You're just throwing away the information from those galaxies because, you know, this pixel isn't 5 sigma above your noise threshold. But those extra photons are still carrying information, and intensity mapping is the kind of really boring sounding name we've given to the process of using all of that extra information. But it basically boils down to you give up altogether on trying to resolve any individual object, because we're cosmologists, we don't care about any individual source. My PhD advisor referred to the other kind of astronomy rather derisively as object-oriented astronomy. So you give up on resolving any individual source, and you just kind of make a low-resolution map of the intensity in your field, hence the name intensity mapping. And so that gives you something like this that I have plotted on the right. And you can see that, you know, these blobs of intensity, you know, kind of trace the same large-scale structure. You can see similar structures present in both fields. But what you're measuring here is you're measuring the aggregate emission of every emitter in this field. And you know, because you're not spending the time it takes to resolve individual objects, we can make this map in, we can get like a 10 sigma detection of structure in this map containing, all of the large scale structure here in less time with a experiment that costs an order of magnitude less money than the VLA. So intensity mapping is kind of a cheap way to get a lot of information.
So I've showed this plot in a number of talks, and I heard a complaint which I didn't have a good answer for, so I'm going to relay that.
Go for it.
Pretend to be that. Yeah. And so if you compare the red dots to the bright yellow splotches on the other side, it seems like the red dots are tracing yellow splotches pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like a lot of the visual information on the right side is just coming from the brightest points.
Yeah, some of it is, and these things are correlated. However, so there's still the point that you're spending a lot less time and money to get this thing, and two, you do have regions like all of this stuff down here, there's no red point in any of this, and then the last thing is the emission in all of these blobs, it's correlated with the red points because you are tracing large scale structure, but there is also information from all of these faint guys in it. And I can show that a little bit more quantitatively in a few slides down the line. So that's the basic idea of intensity mapping. The reason why we go after specifically line intensity mapping is that if I target an emission line specifically, that comes at a very specific, well-defined frequency. And therefore, I can change what redshift I'm measuring signal from by varying my observing frequency. So if I observe at a whole bunch of different closely spaced frequencies, I can build up a three-dimensional picture of large-scale structure, and I can do tomography. So if you were going to kind of make a used car salesman type marketing of this technique, you might say that an intensity map is a volume-limited survey of line emitters with redshift resolution comparable to the best best spectroscopic galaxy surveys. The trade-off, of course, is that you don't actually see any galaxies. So, galaxy surveys, to summarize, galaxy surveys will give you the detailed properties of only the brightest galaxies in your field, whereas the intensity map will give you the statistical properties of all of your galaxies. And that's a, different but also very useful thing. So this is a field that has received a lot of experimental attention of late. The field kind of started off with a big boom in 21 centimeter cosmology. So, I have a hydrogen atom, I got a proton and neutron with this, they each have a spin direction. If I flip from aligned to anti-aligned to aligned spins, I emit a photon with a wavelength of 21 centimeters. And, hydrogen is everywhere. So that provides a nice, fairly clean tracer of large scale structure. So there's experiments like CHIME, for example, which has a lot of people working on it here, which is kind of tracing H1 within galaxies at lower redshifts, kind of mapping onto exactly this picture where you have H1 emitters and you're measuring the aggregate emission of all of them. And then you also have experiments like Hera, which are going after an earlier period of cosmic history, the epoch of reionization, when the interstellar medium was going from neutral hydrogen, which emits H1, to ionized hydrogen, which doesn't. And the tomographic intensity mapping lets you actually follow that process as it happens. So H1 is the first field that got really popular, but people pretty quickly realized that different lines, you observe at different frequencies, you can have very different systematics, which might make one experiment more beneficial than another. And also some of these astrophysical kind of questions. Local universe astronomers don't just like measure a single emission line from a galaxy. They get every emission line they can get their hands on because they all trace different, properties of the objects they're observing. So the probably next most popular is there's a suite of experiments going after a couple of different carbon lines, most notably rotational transitions of the carbon monoxide molecule and fine structure lines of this is singly ionized carbon atoms. Both of these basically boil down to their tracers of star-forming galaxies. So if you're interested in galactic evolution, interstellar medium type questions, star formation is an incredibly critical part of that process. And so these lines basically tell you something about how much star formation is happening in your unresolved galaxy population. And then there's a smattering of other experiments that get a bunch of optical UV infrared lines, most notably this SphereX experiment that NASA just funded a few months ago. Is kind of an all-sky, low-resolution spectroscopy or high-resolution photometry, depending on who you ask, experiment that is sensitive to like five different lines from basically redshift 0 to 10, and can do potentially a lot of exciting things with those. So just to highlight some of the ones that I personally have some involvement in, probably the one I spend the most time on is an experiment called COMAP, which is in operation out at Owens Valley, doing carbon monoxide observations from redshift 2 to 3. There's also these Green Bank Telescope and Parkes detections of 21 centimeter, some of the only actual intensity mapping detections out there that we're doing some fun data analysis on that I'll talk about a little bit later. And I'm not officially a member of SphereX, but I've been thinking about it a lot recently. So if you're interested in that, I have thoughts on the subject. So the basic kind of statistical question that I've been trying to answer for a while is, I make one of these maps. Basically what I've done is I have a data cube giving me intensity at some frequency as a function of frequency and position on the sky. That intensity is coming from, in general, a population of unresolved large-scale structure tracing basically point sources. What is the optimal way to connect that to the underlying physics that we care about? And what is the actual physics that lives in these surveys? So you can think about cosmological questions from the large-scale structure you can see in this, things like BAO, cosmic evolution measurements, things like the Hubble tension, maybe some scale-dependent bias inflation type things. You can think of the scary, messy astrophysical questions, some of these things like feedback, which is how things like quasars and supernovae affect the galaxies that they're happening in. And we want to find a way to actually make this connection between the maps and the underlying physics. And this isn't entirely a straightforward, you might just say, well, we've been doing galaxy surveys in the CMB for years. We know how to do cosmology with these things. Can't we just port over the math we're all used to? But intensity maps kind of behave qualitatively differently than other observables in some important ways. So the main one, which I alluded to earlier, is that compared to galaxy surveys, intensity maps are intentionally confused. You don't actually see any objects. You see some weird blobby mess, even in the best of times. Intensity maps are typically highly non-Gaussian because I'm measuring line emission, and that line emission is being driven by horrible, messy, subgalactic scale, nonlinear awfulness. And so, I could have like some big starburst galaxy here that is making this peak deviate way brighter than the average. Some intuition from CMB science will limit you a bit if you ignore this non-Gaussianity. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, I say I measure, intensity as a function of frequency and position. That doesn't just give me 21 centimeter at redshift 2 or carbon monoxide at redshift 3. That gives me everything else that's coming from the sky at that frequency in that direction. So from CMB community, you may be familiar with things like galactic dust and synchrotron. There's continuum emission from other extragalactic sources. And what you actually measure is, we are measuring every photon. You measure the sum of your target large-scale structure signal plus all of this other foreground stuff. And you need a way to get rid of that, because otherwise you will just get entirely the wrong answer. So how do we, how do we make this yellow arrow in the presence of these problems? Well, the first tool in any cosmologist's toolbox is always the power spectrum. To brutally paraphrase Jane Austen, it's a truth universally acknowledged that a cosmologist in possession of a new observable must inevitably compute its power spectrum. A man in possession of a fortune must be in need of a wife or something along those, something like that. I don't know, something Jane Austen-y. So you can write down the power spectrum of one of these intensity maps in a fairly straightforward way. You know, everything we're talking about here is tracing the underlying dark matter distribution. So you can start with a dark matter power spectrum, which you can, you know, estimate with your favorite Boltzmann code. For most of the talk, I'm going to be assuming the emission is coming from within galaxies. Galaxies are a biased tracer of the dark matter. They're typically more strongly clustered. And so we tackle in a bias factor here. So far, so good so far. And then because we're looking at line emission, we're not just counting galaxies, we weight this whole thing by the sky average mean intensity of the line we're looking at. And it is a convention in this field then that the power spectrum carries around a intensity squared unit with it. So the power spectrum of 21 centimeter, for example, usually has a millikelvin squared unit hanging around on it because of this effect. And that's just a choice of convention. And then if we were actually looking at a continuous smooth background, this would be the whole expression. But as in galaxy surveys, we're actually measuring a smooth overpopulation of point sources. So we have this scale-independent Poisson noise or shot noise term that takes over on small scales. So in all of these measurements, you're taking every galaxy and you're weighting it by how bright it is in your target line. So this power spectrum ends up depending rather strongly on the luminosity function of your target line. So, you know, how many galaxies as a function of luminosity you have. So if I have, you know, skew toward brighter galaxies, the amplitude will increase and my signal to noise will inevitably get better. If I have a higher variance in my luminosity, I'll become more and more shot noise dominated. And so, you know, you put all of this together and you get this kind of characteristic shape like this, where you have, you know, your large scale structure part familiar. You might, you know, be able to make out some BAO wiggles in here being taken over by this scale independent shot noise piece on small scales. And you can kind of see just in this power spectrum expression where, you know, the presence of a lot of this different physics I was talking about mentioning at the beginning, you know, the luminosity function, you know, that depends on things like your interstellar medium physics, how much star formation is going on. And it depends on if I have some of these weird feedback processes that are blowing all of the gas out of my galaxy, then my galaxies are going to get fainter and this amplitude is going to be lower. You know, this, because I'm tracing the matter power spectrum, then that has a lot of the familiar large-scale structure physics in it. You know, I said you can see the BAO features in here we can use for our standard ruler. And these galaxies are a biased tracer, which means a lot of the, you know, things about how the galaxies and the halos connect and any, you know, scale-dependent inflationary non-Gaussian entity effects do live in this bias as we're used to. So, you know, you can take this power spectrum and do a lot of our familiar analyses on it. So as one example, several experiments, most notably CHIME, which, like I said, has a significant presence here at Perimeter, and this kind of sister experiment, HYRAX, in the Southern Hemisphere, are trying to make BAO measurements with 21 centimeter maps. You know, I measure my H1. The H1 is tracing the large-scale structure, and that has BAO in it. And because we're, you know, in this intensity mapping regime where we can push to higher redshifts, we can cover large volumes efficiently, these experiments can make very high quality measurements of the BAO feature, the you know, cosmic evolution, out to much higher redshifts than you can than people have managed to do up till this point. And if we throw in an experiment like SphereX, which I said is sensitive to lines going out even to redshift 10 or so, or maybe, you know, a kind of next generation version of these CO or C2 experiments, you can potentially push these things out even higher. And I think there's a 21 centimeter proposal to go out to higher redshifts as well. So if, for example, you know, this is a period of cosmic history which we just expect to be matter dominated, we don't necessarily expect there to be anything particularly interesting going on there. But, you know, we have this Hubble constant tension thing and we haven't looked there, and, you know, they're going to fly this SphereX satellite, so we may as well see if there's something funny going on there. You know, it's a place we haven't looked yet. So the power spectrum is, as always, a very useful observable. It tells you basically mean invariance of your luminosity function, it has your bias physics, and it has your large-scale structure physics in it. So the power spectrum, you know, those integrals over the luminosity function and things let you deal with the confused part of this, but if my map is contaminated by foregrounds, then I'm just going to be measuring the power spectrum of my signal plus my foregrounds, which is not necessarily helpful. And kind of by definition, the power spectrum doesn't tell you anything about the non-Gaussian properties of the map. So we want to look at some other statistics of our data to try and learn to try and deal with some of these other issues. So I'm going to start with the foreground contamination problem. This problem is by far the biggest in 21 centimeter surveys. 21 centimeter, you're observing at very low frequencies, and most notably, there's synchrotron emission in the Milky Way galaxy that gets very bright at very low frequencies, to the point where it's often 3 to 5 orders of magnitude brighter than the signal. And so there are some ways to get around this, most notably the fact that the foreground signal will be spectrally smooth, whereas your cosmological signal, your frequency direction is your line of sight direction, so it has large-scale structure in it. But you know, if my foregrounds are 10,000 times brighter than my signal, then it only takes like a 1% systematic of some kind in my instrument to completely blow the signal out of the water. And so what I have showing here is a kind of pair of raw 21 centimeter maps from a survey done using the Parkes telescope. You can see here that the fluctuations are, you know, 100 millikelvin to a Kelvin in scale. The kind of signal amplitude we expect in this is like order of maybe a millikelvin or so. And so if you, even after, so they basically do this spectrally smooth foreground cleaning thing on the data, and this is kind of the best maps they can make, and you see the fluctuations are still on the order of several millikelvin, and there's like this weird stripy stuff over here that very clearly isn't large-scale structure. So, you know, you basically would not believe any power any like raw power spectrum you computed from these maps, even after you've done your best to clean the foregrounds. So we need some other statistic, hopefully something that is unbiased by the foregrounds, to actually make believable measurements from this map. And again, the most typical tool cosmologists will use for that is just to do a cross-correlation, to compute the cross-correlation between your 21 centimeter map and some other large-scale structure tracer, with the idea that the two large-scale structure components will be correlated, but the, you know, gas in the Milky Way doesn't care about the large-scale structure, so that part of this, that part of the contamination should vanish away. So I can, you know, I had the auto power spectrum that I wrote before. You can write the cross power spectrum in a very similar way. You pick up one factor just of the bias of the galaxy sample now, because this is assuming I'm cross correlating my intensity map with a more traditional galaxy survey in my same volume. So I get one factor of my line intensity and bias. I get one factor of the bias of my galaxy sample. And because, you know, the galaxies and the 21 centimeters don't necessarily have to live in the same parts of the halos, especially on small scales, they don't have to trace the dark matter exactly the same way, you pick up some cross-correlation coefficients to account for, you know, what basically boils down to nonlinearities in how these two tracers trace the dark matter. And so when they took those maps I showed you a few minutes ago and did a cross-correlation like this, they were able to get a 5 sigma detection of cross-power between the 21 centimeter and the galaxies. And you know, that is because of the cross-power spectrum, that is much more robust, that is actually cosmological signal rather than Milky Way stuff that we don't care about. They also saw, you know, pointing to some of the ways that this nonlinearity can give you extra information about physics, you know, this black line here is basically showing what you would get if everything was linearly tracing the dark matter. And you know, these points, especially on small scales, are significantly below that. So this cross-correlation coefficient is less than 1 on small scales, which is basically saying that galaxies that contain, you know, neutral hydrogen is avoiding the brightest galaxies on small scales, which is a pointer to things like cluster heating that we see in simulations.
What redshift is the emission?
This redshift is coming from like 0.05 or so. They have another data set that's very similar at redshift 0.8. Yeah.
So how do you know that you're correlating a signal with the galaxies? Because that's what the program also comes from, the galaxies, or this part of the program comes from the galaxies.
Right, so the reason you can be reasonably confident is that if you're the foreground part that comes from galaxies is genuinely also continuum. So basically, if you know, I shift the galaxies, if I cross-correlate the galaxies with different frequencies of my 21 centimeter map, you see an excess when the galaxies are at exactly the right redshift versus when they're offset slightly. Because if I have a continuum emission, the frequency direction is the line of sight. So if I, I think about the best way to say this. If I was correlating the continuum emission with my galaxies, then I wouldn't have to have the galaxies at exactly the right redshift to see a cross correlation, because I'm basically looking at a two-dimensional correlation. But my three-dimensional correlation will peak when my galaxies are at the same redshift that H1 would be coming from.
As far as that all redshift, so it's not that you get to peak very far. So as far as every at all redshift that your galaxies you have, you get to choose. So it could be that you're correlating the H1 signal with the position of the galaxy.
That was graceful.
And it could be that you're correlating the foreground emission, the synchrotron from the galaxies with the position of the galaxies. So
it basically boils down to the synchrotron is continuum, so the synchrotron correlation is basically two-dimensional on the sky.
Yeah.
Whereas the H1 is coming at a single frequency,
it's
so that's...
It's the same idea that the high pass versus low.
Yeah, it's a similar idea. There is no way to be absolutely confident that you've gotten rid of all of it, but this is about the safest you can be in a measurement like this. And so this type of cross-correlation is where we've gotten basically every intensity map and every good intensity mapping detection that we've had so far. So there's these 5 and 7 sigma detections of H1 with Parkes and the Green Bank telescope. There's a 4 sigma detection of this C2 line at redshift 3 done by cross-correlating the Planck data with Boss galaxies. And there they had to work really hard because Planck has comparatively terrible frequency resolution to make sure they weren't getting continuum, basically CIB, cosmic infrared background in that. And then there's a 5 sigma detection of Wyman alpha in the intensity mapping regime, also from the Boss survey. And so if we compare that to the auto spectrum detection, that same GBT survey quoted an upper limit on the H1 auto spectrum at redshift 0.8, but they weren't able to go below that because they don't know how much of their quote-unquote signal is actually foregrounds. And we have 1 3-sigma detection of CO, a very small-scale CO shot noise power at redshift 3. And I use detection slightly, somewhat lightly here because 3 sigma is, pretty marginal. So the cross spectrum is right now the only tool we've actually gotten to work so far for these surveys. But in addition to the fact that the cross spectrum helps you remove foregrounds, do I have a question?
Yeah. So in the case that you've done these cross spectrum analyses, what is the substantial new information that you've gotten from having this line intensity map? Because you already had the galaxy tracer, you already had a map of structure at this redshift. So
right. That is next few slides. So so the cross spectra, they can so the cross spectra contains some new information. Most notably about a lot of the astrophysical stuff. So I mentioned earlier how this cross-correlation coefficient can tell you something about how the different objects are tracing halos in different ways. But if you look at the shot noise in a cross-correlation, shot noise is basically what you get from the correlation of each galaxy with itself. It's the power you would have if the galaxy positions were totally uncorrelated, if my field was totally random. And so if I'm going to have shot noise in a cross-correlation, that means I have to have the same object that's both emitting the line I'm going after and is present in my optical galaxy survey. And so that means that my cross-power spectrum tells me the mean line luminosity, not of my entire galaxy population, but only of the galaxies in my optical survey. So it might be, you know, one thing to go get galaxies' optical luminosities, but really expensive to go try and find all of them in H1, but this would tell me how much H1 is in my optical galaxies. Conversely, you know, this tells me the mean H1 luminosity of my entire galaxy population, but if I want to subdivide that, if I want to, you know, learn something about how that depends on other galaxy properties, this gives me a way to do that. So a few people have looked at different things about this. So one example for the H1 is if you look at the colors of galaxies, the galaxies kind of tend to fall into two overall populations. There's blue galaxies, which tend to be brighter and have a lot of gas and tend to be actively forming stars. And then there's these bigger red galaxies, which tend to have almost no gas in them and tend to be forming very few stars. And this would basically provide a way to kind of trace how the neutral gas is behaving in these different galaxies and kind of try to get a feel for why these two different populations exist, which we don't really understand. We had a paper recently looking at how you could get a probe of quasar feedback with this. The idea being basically if quasars are blasting all of the gas out of your galaxy, then this number should be a lot smaller for if you cross-correlate with quasars than if you cross-correlate with things that don't have quasars in them. So there's a bunch of extra astrophysical information that you get from your cross-spectrum in addition to being more confident that you've actually made a successful measurement.
Is that a prediction, or is that something you have a measurement on?
So this is these are both predictions of things we can do with some of those experiments on that, you know, list I showed at the beginning. These are both things that can be done with near future experiments, but have not quite been managed yet.
I guess it assumes you've got enough K range that you think you can separate the left hand term from the right hand term.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, what we did in this paper is go through four, you know, some models of these things and the sensitivities of the different experiments and figured out basically what kind of constraints could you put on this number, and found that near future experiments are sensitive enough to say interesting things about the subject. One reason why I end up spending, despite coming from a cosmology background, spend more and more time on these kind of astrophysical questions is the error bars tend to be dramatically larger than cosmology questions. So you don't necessarily have to get like to percent level measurements before you're doing interesting science when the thing you're measuring is unknown at the order of magnitude level. So you could also, you know, do something similar to this if I cross-correlated two different lines, where I could look at how, you know, line luminosities vary with respect to each other. There's a lot of different ways you can use cross-power spectra to project out different aspects of your galaxy populations. So cross-spectra, you know, they are both much more robust to various kinds of foreground contamination, and they also contain a bunch more astrophysical information than auto power spectra. But they still don't really help you with the non-Gaussianity part. You know, they can get the Gaussian components of different subsets of your population, but they don't really get at this non-Gaussian information. You know, they won't really tell you that there's a really bright spot right here. And when I say non-Gaussianity here, I'm referring to a slightly different kind of non-Gaussianity than a lot of cosmological observables. The non-Gaussianity here is basically entirely local. It basically boils down to, if I made a histogram of this map, it would not be a Gaussian. You know, star formation doesn't talk to each other from here to here, the star formation physics that's making the non-Gaussianity. So, you know, the normal statement people make when they're thinking about non-Gaussianity is to go after things like three-point functions and the like, but we're going to go after something somewhat simpler. So,
before you go there, yes, just a quick question. So, you kind of have made some sort of implicit assumption about non-Gaussianity in the way you're modeling the power spectrum, because you're saying that the types of nonlinearities you expect to find in your intensity maps are related to the types of nonlinearities you find in dark matter.
Right.
By assuming that, you can rely on bias.
Right.
So will that play in here? Will that be affected? How good of an assumption is that?
So it's a slightly different assumption than that. So the specific assumption where, so there are, you know, like kind of standard cosmological non-Gaussianities you can compute from these, but the kind I'm looking at is more specifically, what I'm going to focus on again is this luminosity function. So my luminosity function from this, I get the mean invariance, but galaxy luminosity functions are not entirely described by their mean invariance. You know, kind of the most general form for a luminosity function tends to be something like a Schechter function, where I have like a power law and then an exponential cutoff, where I need an amplitude, a slope, and a location of the cutoff. I need three numbers to describe it. And so there is non-Gaussian information in this thing, which is being missed by your power spectrum. So that's the piece that I'm going to focus on. And because that's being entirely driven by, you know, physics that is basically unique to each individual galaxy, the quantity we're going to look at to try to probe it is we're going to look at the one-point statistics of of our intensity maps. Specifically, we're going to adapt an old radio astronomy technique called P of D analysis, which stands for probability of deflection, referring to the deflection of a like stylus on a piece of paper as you scan an interferometer across the sky, to give an idea of what I mean by old radio astronomy technique. And the kind of classical idea of this is, you know, I have some field of unresolved radio sources, and I'm not necessarily doing cosmology here. These don't have to have large-scale structure in them or anything. This is just, it's hard to get good angular resolution at radio frequencies. And, you know, I might have some, if I take every, you know, I split this map into pixels, I put the value of those pixels into a histogram, I might have some Gaussian white noise that I would expect, but then every contribution from an astrophysical source is going to make me deviate from that Gaussian noise. And so these red points are basically what you get for some population of point sources in this map. And by measuring how this deviates from a Gaussian, you get a measurement of the luminosity function, or the luminosity function of your underlying sources. And so this maps really well into intensity mapping because you know the distance to, you know, I can take, I now don't just have 2D pixels, I have 3D voxels in my map. So I have a lot of, you know, I have a lot of structure, spatial ability to distinguish the spatial structure of my map. And so I can take that whole 3D cube, I can make a whole histogram of that, and, you know, I get something like this, where this is a Schechter function model where I've put another exponential cutoff on the small scales, on the low end, to make everything stay well-behaved. I might convolve this with some Gaussian noise, and then I get a quantity which depends on my entire luminosity function, not just the mean invariance thereof.
So this is the PDF of the filtered map.
Right.
That seems kind of complicated, right? Because now you've got a way certain name of this SMI made online voxels correlated in some complicated way, right?
Right. So yeah, so what you're basically, so what, when you're doing a one-point map like this, you are importing, always assuming some spatial, there's a single spatial scale that you always have to assume, and that is the scale of your voxel. And that, you know, kind of this naive statement that you know, the PDF on that scale should look something like the luminosity function, modulo some prior on how many galaxies I have in a pixel and things, is kind of qualitatively clear, but not necessarily quantitatively obvious. So what we did is we ran a whole bunch of simulations because some of these physics are difficult to model analytically. So we used this suite of peak patch simulations, which are very popular at CETA. And we, you know, made like 5,000 maps. We computed their power spectra. We computed this histogram. We computed the covariances between them because we have 5,000 maps. And we looked at what kind of measurement you could make of a luminosity function. And so if you actually have unique information in these two statistics, then your luminosity function measurement with both statistics will be better than either one by itself. And so what we have plotted here is the error on the luminosity function from just using the power spectrum, from using this one-point statistic, and from the combination of the two. And what you see is basically, especially at the bright end, because that's what the, you know, where the this histogram is least contaminated by the noise, your 1-point statistic is adding a whole bunch of extra information and improving your measurement significantly. And you know, this is dex on the axis, x y axis. So this is a log axis. So this is a pretty significant difference.
Dex is what? Dex of what?
This is basically the log of the log of my luminosity function. So it's a little more clear if I plot it like this. So what I have plotted here is basically showing what this lets you do, how much better this lets you, this, you know, intensity mapping with these, you know, non-Gaussian statistics lets you do than prior measurements. So this green band is kind of the green band and the orange boxes are kind of the best existing direct galaxy observation measurements of the luminosity function of CO at this redshift. The blue band is that 3-sigma CO intensity mapping detection I mentioned. And this red band is, with around our fiducial model, the error we forecast with this 1 and 2-point statistics measurement. And you can just see that this is dramatically better than anything that has been done previously. And this corresponds to like an 8-sigma detection of the power spectrum. So you know, you get an 8-sigma measurement and you get a huge improvement on how I understand this quantity. And you can take this and you can constrain things like, you know, I said we're going after CO because it's a star formation tracer. You can measure things like the total amount of star formation in the universe. And so these gray points are kind of the state of the art. People go after galaxies in their UV luminosity, but they're directly imaging galaxies and they're only detecting the bright ones. So you have to extrapolate that down to the faint end and assume you know there's not any significant star formation in faint galaxies. These blue and green boxes are basically what you would get from these blue and green measurements of the luminosity function, and they are so big as to be basically useless. But then this red box is what you would get from the CO observation. And you can see that that is getting to a comparable level of error to the kind of state-of-the-art direct measurements, but with a sensitivity to the faint galaxy population. So if there is a significant amount of star formation happening in faint galaxies, which there could be, we don't understand this at all, you would see it in the intensity map and you would not see it in the direct galaxy surveys.
This is a forecast,
so yeah. This becomes even more important at very high redshifts. There's this kind of debate in the people who measure these star formation things at very high redshift. Specifically, there's these gamma ray burst measurements where if you assume gamma ray bursts, or at least certain classes of them, come from dying massive stars, then massive stars die almost immediately after they're born, and gamma ray bursts should be a tracer of star formation. You get a noticeably higher star formation rate from gamma ray bursts than you do from conventional measurements. And you know, this is during reionization out here, when the star formation is presumably ionizing all of the gas in the universe and making this tau number that CMB cosmologists get really annoyed by. And so if we could actually measure this, you know, kind of better than either of these at high redshift, it would be a really useful thing to do. And so we can kind of take our, you know, our forecasts from down here and kind of forecast what we could hope to do with planned measurements at higher redshift. The blue band basically corresponds to, I know exactly how carbon monoxide and star formation are related. The pink band is with some reasonable uncertainty on that, which, you know, because astrophysics is hard, kind of has to exist. But even in the conservative case, the CO intensity map is providing enough information to kind of solve this tension. So we can add to our list our 1-point statistic, which tells you something about the full non-Gaussian behavior of our line luminosity function.
So is the improvements that you're getting here mainly in like the faint part of the luminosity function or the end of the velocity?
So it depends which line you're looking at. For CO, it's both. You know, that red band is skinnier everywhere. But the comparison between the direct Measurements is the direct measurements will never tell you anything about the faint end of the luminosity function.
Yes, I'm still, I guess, like puzzled why getting any information from this one-point PDF. So the observed PDF is like a convolution of the intrinsic PDF and the noise PDF.
Right.
And so for the faint end, where you're like you're much fainter than the noise,
mm-hmm.
how do I even notice that that those sources are there when the noise PDF is so? So
right. So at some point, so this is why, if I look at these things, so the power spec, so the reason is basically that you have the combination of these two things. So the power spectrum is giving you the integral of everything, and the vid, the one-point statistics, is breaking down the bright end. So if I have the integral over the whole thing.
Okay, so it is the bright end, really.
Yeah, so the one-point statistics are best at the bright end, but then the power spectrum is...
Some
integral constraint over the whole thing, and those two things together really let you.
Okay, so therefore, in your curve showing that band, that was for some model, I guess.
Yeah. So this is basically all of the. So this is basically assuming some model, which you can see is consistent with the very uncertain nature of these things, and we get assume some model, get some constraint around that, and we do.
Yeah, you're not comparing just using power spectrum in power spectrum plus.
Yeah, so these two are not intensity mapping at all. These two are actually like we found some galaxies and counted them. This one is just a power spectrum, but they only had this like 3-sigma detection on very small scales. And then this is power spectrum plus 1-point statistics with the experiment that is currently observing in California right now.
If you just use power spectrum for the red band, then probably you would get more attention than just high luminosity, but the low luminosity never become parallel.
Well, basically, you'd end up effectively, how wide your band got would end up being determined almost a lot by your priors, because it takes more than, you would measure the mean and variance of this thing, but it takes more than those two numbers to describe the shape of this curve. So you would have degeneracies, basically, whereas the 1-point lets you nail down here, and then the fact that I have an integral tells me, how much has to be coming from down there. Does that make sense? So there's one thing, though, about these two beyond the power spectrum statistics, though. This guy isn't sensitive to the non-Gaussianity. And when I was talking about this, I was saying I have to convolve my signal with my instrument noise. That means I also have to convolve my signal with the PDF of my foregrounds. Now, for a line like carbon monoxide, the foregrounds aren't that bad, and we think we might be able to beat them down to a low enough. We think we can beat them down to a low enough level to use this. But for H1, for that H1 map I showed earlier, using this would require modeling the probability distribution of your foregrounds to the sub-percent level, which just will not ever happen to the required level of precision. So if I want to find a way to combine the benefits of both of these things, if I want to find a way to get the non-Gaussian information about a foreground contaminated map, then I need to find some 1-point statistics equivalent of a cross power spectrum. I need to write down something that some kind of 1-point statistic that is at least as foreground unbiased as a cross power spectrum would be. And we think we found a way to do that. And so what we basically do is instead of just writing down the probability distribution of temperature, we look at one of these data sets where I have an emission line and a galaxy survey, and we write down for each pixel the probability of temperature given how many optical galaxies I have in that pixel. And for at least a lot of the data sets we have, the resolutions we have, that number is usually either 0 or 1. What this effectively means is I take my data cube, I split it into two lists of pixels. I make histograms of those two different lists, and I look at how those lists are different. And so what you get is something like this, where this is a kind of a toy forecast model of that Parks 5-sigma map I showed earlier. So over here, I have my two histograms normalized so that I can see them both on the same plot easily. The blue is for pixels or voxels being proper that don't have a galaxy in them, and the red is for voxels which do have galaxies in them, optically detected galaxies. All of them have unresolved 21 centimeter galaxies in them. And for this particular plot, I've added some really big Gaussian model for my foreground PDF, but in principle, I can add some arbitrary PDF to this. So you can see that what you expect to see is that pixels that have a spectroscopic galaxy are slightly brighter than pixels which don't, which kind of makes sense. The optical galaxy probably has some H1 in it that's adding to my signal. And B, because large-scale structure is a thing, a pixel with a galaxy will tend to have more unresolved emission than average. But if I actually wanted to get anything more than just the mean offset between these things, I would need a model for this foreground PDF, which I don't have. But what I can do, as I said before, that when I add noise to a map, I convolve the probability distributions. So that means, assuming my noise and foregrounds are uncorrelated with large-scale structure, which is the assumption you make in any cross-correlation, these two things should have statistically different signals and statistically the same foregrounds. So I should be able to deconvolve one of these by the other one and cancel out the foregrounds from the result. Because I've convolved the same foreground into both of these. And so the deconvolution should cancel out the similar component from both measurements. And so what you get when you do that is something over here, which I've left in Fourier space because the error bars look less horrible. The black points and error bars are what you get from deconvolving this toy model I have over here. And this black line is what you get if I take the astrophysical model I used over here, and I don't put any foregrounds in it at all, and apply the same deconvolution. And so what you see here is that, at least to within the errors, and the errors are correlated, which is why there's some kind of systematic offset here, I have a statistic where the measurement for a map with foregrounds gives me the same thing I would have got for a map without foregrounds. And so just like the cross power spectrum, I have a foreground unbiased statistic, but now it should be sensitive to the non-Gaussian information. Does that make sense? I'm seeing some confused faces, but not hearing questions. Yeah. And so what we can do is basically, we are looking to apply this to real data. We are working on applying this to the actual data right now. But in the near term, we can basically take this thing and do like a Fisher forecast type thing on it just to see what information lives in it. And so so that's what I have plotted here, where if you just start out looking at the left, the solid lines are two different sets of priors, basically two different assumptions about how much I know about this quantity before I add this weird one-point deconvolution thing to it. And then the two colored bands are what I get after my Fisher forecast. And you can see, even when I assume like I know a lot about these measurements, so like these, this is a forecast for this redshift 0.05 measurement. So if I assume I can use measurements we have at redshift 0 as priors on this, that's what gives me the red band. And I'm still adding a significant amount of information about the faint end of my 21 centimeter luminosity function. And the other thing I can do, just like in my cross power spectra, is I can separate out the information about my cross correlation galaxies from my fainter galaxies. So I can actually measure specifically the luminosity functions of my optical galaxies in my cross correlation sample versus that of my galaxies, the fainter unresolved galaxies. So I'm getting non-Gaussianity, and I'm also gaining this ability to project out subpopulations that I showed earlier. So this intensity mapping field is still pretty young compared to other cosmological observables. We're still kind of feeling our way a bit towards what the best ways are to get information out of these maps. But we're kind of starting to assemble a toolkit for you know, how we will go about extracting physics from these unresolved galaxy populations. And a number of these experiments are going to be producing data in the next couple of years. So this kind of, you know, theory back-end work is important and urgent, and I think kind of getting there. So I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Questions for Patrick?
I guess what I'm thinking is that you're using basically two facts. One is that, or this assumption, one is that the larger scale things follow, matter powers or matter density fluctuations, which are approximately Gaussian, but
mm-hmm.
then at the smaller scales you have Poisson adjustment, basically Poisson statistics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which is what's responsible for the pay.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, if those are your two basic assumptions, instead of just kind of in a hot wave making up a statistics, you could just write down the full likelihood and see what's the, I mean, just use that.
I mean, doing some kind of non-parametric, just you mean something where you just like simulate?
Well, no, I'm just suggesting to write down the likelihoods for a given, what is the probability of getting basically a certain intensity map with a certain distribution of galaxies, given the underlying matter density.
Right.
And it's just basically Gaussian statistics for matter, and then Poisson statistics for point sources.
Well, it's Poisson statistics for the location of point sources, but then like Schechter function type statistics for the weight given to the point sources.
Schechter function is just unparameterized.
Yes, unparameterized, but it's not quite like, if it was just Gaussian density fluctuations with Poisson statistics, and the power spectrum would tell you everything.
No, because the Poisson statistics, the power spectrum doesn't tell you.
Well, that would be just the amplitude of the shot noise. I mean, that's like basically
But the thing is that the maps are not Gaussian anymore because of them. So there is more information
right.
in the
mm-hmm.
In the tail of that.
Yeah.
So, but I guess what
I'm saying is the point, though, is that the high K amplitude is telling you that all the numbers, you know, if it's just pure white noise on top of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that case, I mean, if you're right, then the computation would tell you everything.
Yeah. So the important difference is I don't just have point sources. I'm weighting each point source by how much molecular gas is in them, which is some totally different scale. My large scale modes now have this weird like parsec scale physics going into their weighting.
The non-Gaussianity tells you about the luminosity function, because the rarer things are, the more skewed their PDF is. So it's the power spectrum of even the shot noise, it doesn't give you everything. It just gives you one integral over the
right.
Luminosity function.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't done it, but I'm just thinking that this is kind of a fact. It's just, let's pick this one and that one, and that's all the information. Of course, there's probably
yeah.
more information.
No, so there definitely is more. So, I mean, even just like a naive extension of this is you could write down the full two-point mm-hmm. probability distribution. You could say probability of, you know, temperature here and temperature here, given the distance between them at some point. So I think the kind of approach we've been taking is kind of building up statistics where we think we can get a handle where we kind of believe our ability to connect them to the models. But no, this is not all of the information in maps by a long shot, but this is, I think, a large chunk of it. I think the 1 point adds a significant chunk in these observables that we don't have in the other ones.
Okay. Question. You
mm-hmm.
had sort of planned to the velocity function of that. It's a statistic that the PDF is going to constrain.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect that the limit PDF would also be useful for cosmological parameters like sigma?
Yeah, so one thing that we kind of have a qualitative idea about but haven't gotten around to doing a like full forecast for is if you think about the power spectrum, the like F sigma 8, the amplitude of the dark matter power spectrum is now like entirely degenerate with this like the mean intensity of the line, which in principle, adding something like a non-integral measurement of the luminosity function to that could probably help break that degeneracy. But the bias and the fluctuation amplitude and things do come into the one point in a kind of non-trivial way, which we just want to, basically another thing we need to pull out of the giant pile of simulations that we haven't gotten around to yet. But at the very least, at the degeneracy breaking level, there's information there, and there might be more beyond that. Just haven't done it yet.
Are there no more questions?